We are at the Santa Fe Institute at a workshop on systems biology and the physical foundations of aging with Tom Kirkwood, who's director of the Institute for Aging and Health at the University of Newcastle in UK. Tom, welcome. You mentioned earlier in there, you had a very nice phrase when we were talking this, some very technical language was going on, and you said, we in this room are mortal. But there's a trace of immortality in the sense that every cell can trace its lineage back to the origins of cellular life. And I think we sometimes forget that there is this extraordinary context going back,
Yeah, it really is one of the most amazing things about the aging process, that we have this paradox that, you know, we know we're going to die. And we know that there is this inevitability about the process of aging. And yet, if we were to reverse the trajectory of time, we would find that, you know, sort of we would go back to a single cell, and we could trace that cell back through the cells of our mother and father and back through their parents. So this chain of life is unbroken. And you could take any cell from your body and it would have this amazing antiquity of a family tree going right back 4 billion years on Earth. So what is it about the lineage of cells that led to us, we know as the germline, that has this property of immortality, and yet we have this terrible situation that we have to confront the inevitable mortality of nearly every cell within our body? The only cells that will not die when we die are the cells through which we might have given rise to our kids, and so that lineage will hopefully travel on into the future, who knows where.
Let's just talk about this workshop to begin with. Is there something, we have a special congregation of people here, we're talking about systems biology.
Yeah.
Is this a new way of looking at aging?
Aging is incredibly complex, and the exciting thing about systems biology is that we're beginning to see the coming together of different disciplines that provide the capacity and the critical mass to look at a complex process and really begin to make some headway in understanding it. And that's why, of course, it's very appropriate to be here in Santa Fe, where these kind of big questions are addressed. And I mean, my personal belief is that we will not understand aging unless we bring a systems biology perspective to bear. But I guess that raises the question, what do we mean by systems biology? And really what we mean by systems biology is the working together of people who can bring a quantitative insight. They can model the changes that are occurring in the molecules, the genes, the cells, the tissues, the organs of the body. Hopefully build models that can be used predictively, because there's not a great deal of value in developing models that simply describe what we see. The challenge is to capture the essence of the process in a way that can predict things that experimentalists can then get into the lab or, you know, sort of into the population and test and bring the fruit of that test back to the modeling process. Now, in a way, you could say that's the old model of the method of science, that you have hypothesis, you have experiment, you refine your hypothesis, and the circle turns. The thing with systems biology is that the coupling is much tighter than it has been in traditional scientific research. And also, we've got masses and masses of data that will be very difficult for us to get our heads around unless we bring some of the tools of computational modeling, of really quite complicated statistical inference. We're dealing with systems where there's a lot of noise in the system. So there's a great deal of what we call stochasticity in these processes. At its heart, there's very compelling evidence that the aging process is driven by the accumulation of damage in the molecules and cells of our body, but there is also a degree of regulation. And so, you know, trying to get your head around all of these different facets of the aging process is something that a single discipline is no longer finding very easy to do.
Well, now set the context here, because it seems rather... I mentioned in passing at the beginning of the meeting this morning that if one looks back to the writings of Francis Bacon in 1619, 1623, two volumes and something in the Novum Organum as well, where he's going in some detail into trying to understand aging. It's obviously not at a molecular level and so on and so forth, but the basic premises are all somewhat set out there. And 400 years on, we're still looking at this sort of thing. Why has it become so pertinent now, and why is it taking so long to get a real discipline going?
There's really a sort of coming together of two quite different things. The first is that we've known about aging. Of course, you know, everyone learns about aging very early on in their lives. Usually when you're about 3 or 4 years old, the penny drops that your grandparents are somehow that much more frail, that likely to die sooner than your parents and yourself. That realization usually only comes later, when we sort of comprehend our own mortality. But this familiarity with the aging process, in a way, is a part of the problem, because we're so familiar with aging, we've grown up with all kind of preconceptions about it. And of course, the challenge that we face now is that we're discovering that perhaps 90% of what we thought we knew about aging is wrong. So over the last 2 to 3 decades, there have been a couple of really profound alterations in our view of aging. One of these comes from what is happening in populations, in demography. It was thought up until about 1980 that there was something fixed and given about the aging process. So if you look back to the forecast by the best demographic brains in the world in 1980 on behalf of agencies like the United Nations, they were predicting that life expectancy in humans, which had been increasing steadily over the last 200 years, would simply bump up against a ceiling and would not increase further, because, you know, sort of, we'd made all the gains that could be made by reducing infection and deaths in the early and middle years of life, and there was nowhere else to go. We would just be left with more old people, more sickness, more, you know, sort of bad stuff that comes with aging. But if you look at the statistics of life expectancy for the last 30 years, you find that life expectancy has continued to increase at exactly the same rate that it was increasing before. But the extraordinary thing is that the process that is driving that increase is now fundamentally different. Whereas in the past it was driven by a decline in the death rate in the early and middle years of life, it's now driven exclusively by declining death rates at the oldest ages. So there is something quite profound that's happening to aging in our population. And, you know, we make jokes that 70 is the new 50, but actually the science is real. People are reaching old age in better shape. So this is proof positive from just the demography, from the, you know, observing what's happening in populations, that the aging process is intrinsically more malleable than used to be thought. It's not set in stone. It's not fixed. It's yielding to the kind of changes that are occurring in our lifestyles. So that's the first reason why this is a challenge, because governments around the world are facing a situation where life expectancy is increasing by around 2 years each decade. And just to put that into context, what that means is that life expectancy in the US today and in the UK and West European countries has increased by 5 to 6 hours. So it's amazing. You know, when you and I got out of bed this morning, we were waking up not to a 24-hour day, but to a 29-hour day. And we'll enjoy 24 of those hours now. But each day we're putting by another 5 hours for the future. And so the big challenge is, what are all these accumulated 5 hours going to be like when we come to use them? So governments are worried. They're worried about healthcare costs, they're worried about pension costs. And each of us as an individual should be, not worried, but we should be thinking constructively about, you know, sort of what's going to happen in our future. What can I do now to ensure that that extra life that now is accumulating for me in the future is going to be as good as it possibly can be? Now, the other remarkable development is that we've made great strides in understanding the biology of aging over the last few decades. It used to be thought that aging was just too complicated a process, really, for science to be able to understand. You know, aging, it was just a lot of bad stuff happening, and nobody really inquired about what was driving it. But now we see that, yes, it is challenging, it is complicated, but actually we've got some pretty good insights into why it occurs, and we're beginning to learn a great deal about how it occurs. But this is throwing up its intrinsic complexity, and this is why we need to bring new ways of working to the science of aging.
There were issues in there. There was a little round Robin there about people about whether they wanted to define what they meant by aging, and people had different definitions. There was somebody was talking, Michael Rose was talking about aging as a failure of adaptation. Then Lipsitz was talking about aging as an inability of the organism to respond to stress. I mean, these are all correct, obviously, but your response was to say, let's not define this at this point. Let's find out what the characteristics are.
Yes.
As I understood you, anyway.
I think it's a very understandable, you know, sort of wish to define aging. But what we know is that people have been trying to do this for half a century and more. And we all know broadly what aging is. But when we try to define it in any kind of detail, it turns out to be kind of slippery. It's a bit like a bar of soap in the bath. You try and sort of get a grip on it, and suddenly it's shot out from between your fingers. Yeah. And aging is just like that. So probably the best way to define aging is a very broad global definition, to say that aging is the progressive loss of vitality and functional capacity that occurs through life that eventually makes us more liable to fall sick and die. So that's a very broad brush description. But when we try to go deeper than that, we find that the only way we can get a working definition of any particular component of aging is to know more about it. So trying to get the definition in ahead of doing the research is a bit like putting the cart before the horse.
Most of the information about aging that reaches a popular audience, that there's a large audience at this point, apart from the fact that they obviously see that they are aging their relatives and so on and so forth, I mean, there's practical evidence of what's going on. But there's also the big articles like the recent one in The Economist, the special report on aging and so on, that says by the year 2050, according to the UN, as you just said, the populations are going to increase. It's going to be a much grayer, older population and so on. We read about possibly prolonging life by drinking red wine, resveratrol. So we hear about all these various. And there's also a suggestion from some quarters that if you apply the right technical fixes to a series of situations, problems with aging, that you could in fact prolong life to Methuselah lengths, as it were. Can you put that all that stuff into context and say, from your perspective, what's realistic and what we should be looking at this point?
Well, perhaps the first thing to say is that people have always been fascinated by the idea of immortality, of significant extension of lifespan. So it's very easy to get someone's attention by saying that human beings are going to live to 500 years, you know, sort of very soon. The truth is that kind of significant increase in lifespan within the foreseeable future, yeah, is almost certainly not going to happen. And the reason for that is that we know enough about the biology of aging to know just how very complicated it is. So the kind of the recipes for, you know, you need to fix this, you need to fix that, you need to fix the other in order to be able to significantly extend lifespan are based on the most unbelievably naive portrayal of the science of aging. We actually know that most of those mechanisms that tend to appear on these lists are far, far more complicated. And aging is, you know, is actually intrinsically a much more challenging and exciting and difficult area of science than those kind of simple analyses would give it credit for. That's not to say that we shouldn't be excited and positive about what may become possible. I think we will continue to see some very important improvements in the capacity to deliver greater health for longer. But I just don't think we should get excited about the possibility that there is going to be some quick fix or dramatic breakthrough. I mean, the idea that a simple agent, you know, sort of something you might be able to take in a pill, something that you might get from drinking red wine, is going to have these profound effects on the aging process is just, you know, sort of implausible. And the evidence where we look at it is actually strongly against that. But it is very important to recognize that we have seen over the last few decades gains in life expectancy that have come from the rather less exciting but very, very important benefits of improved living circumstances, improved nutrition. And we know for a fact that if you eat the right kinds of things and you don't eat too much, if you take exercise, if you develop a positive attitude towards the aging process, you can make a real contribution to improving your chance of living a good, long and healthy life. And what we also know, and this is very important in today's world, is that there are a large number of people whose lives are cut short by adverse factors, by not eating the right kind of diet, by, you know, sort of living in poor circumstances. We know that there is a strong gradient of life expectancy and health expectancy that goes with socioeconomic status. So I think there's a real challenge in our societies to understand what it is that means that, you know, within the UK, there is a difference in life expectancy between, you know, sort of the richer parts in a city like Glasgow and the poorer parts in a city like Glasgow of as much as 20 years. That is huge.
Yeah.
And all of this actually fits with our understanding of the complexity of the aging process, because we know that aging is driven by the lifelong gradual accumulation of cellular and molecular damage. And we're beginning to understand that what you eat actually has an impact on the rate at which such damage accumulates. So if you eat the wrong foods, if you eat a whole lot of saturated fat, and if you eat a lot of sugar, it doesn't just make you overweight and unhealthy, it actually contributes to the accumulation of damage that drives the aging process. If you take exercise, for example, it actually empowers the body's natural maintenance and repair systems that protect us against the accumulation of damage. So, you know, although this is in some ways, you know, sort of less apparently sexy than some of the other areas of science, it's an area where we actually have proof positive that it works, and there is an enormous gain for individuals and for society at large in being able to identify the molecular and cellular mechanisms through which this works. And through that knowledge, we will open up the ways into the future of delivering more significant gains.
Now, in parallel with this program, which is about diet, nutrition, metabolism, aging, and so on, we're also assembling some information about sleep, waking up to sleep.
Yeah.
Why do we sleep?
Yes.
And I've been to a number of meetings on this. I've talked to a number of colleagues and other researchers about there is not a consensus about why we sleep.
Yeah.
Is there a consensus about why we age, proximate and ultimate reasons, or could you at least set out what the race card is on those things?
Okay, all right. I think there's a broad consensus about the framework within which explanations of why we age are constructed. And that is a recognition that in any species, humans, mice, whatever, if you track a group of individuals from birth onwards, you will find that some of them will die, and they will die from extrinsic causes. You know, they will die from accidents, they'll die being eaten by predators, they'll die of starvation, they'll die of cold, whatever. Now, in nature, we know that actually these pressures of mortality are pretty heavy. So the chances of a wild animal reaching a good old age are very, very small indeed. And as the number of survivors declines, so the force of natural selection, the capacity of natural selection to, you know, sort of keep things going in good shape, just falls away. So what we understand to be the background to all explanations of why we age is the fact that there is this diminution in the capacity of natural selection to look after us as we get older. Now, I became involved in this field of research 30-odd years ago when I suggested a concept called the disposable soma theory, which says that because this happens, because we have only a very small chance in the wild environment of living very long, actually natural selection doesn't place a great priority on investing in the mechanisms of cellular maintenance and repair that would be necessary to keep the body going indefinitely. You know, because life in the wild is nasty, brutish and short, the priority is on growing to reach reproductive maturity and then reproducing as fast as you can, so that when the inevitable happens and you're struck down by one of these extrinsic causes of mortality, you've created genetic progeny to, you know, to carry the genes on into the future. And the prediction from that is very clearly that selection tunes the mechanisms of investment in maintenance and repair of the body to be appropriate for the ecological circumstances in which we live. So if you happen to be, yes, a small animal, a mouse, for example, very vulnerable to a whole host of factors out there that could kill you, it doesn't pay to invest a lot in cellular maintenance and repair, because the chances are you aren't going to live very long anyway. 90% of wild mice are dead before they're 10 months old. So the chances of a mouse in the wild living beyond 15 months are pretty vanishingly small. So you don't need a body that would last forever. A body that keeps the animal in good shape through perhaps 18 months is plenty. And what we see is that if you take mice from the wild environment and you keep them in protected circumstances, okay, they may live 3 years, but you know, so that they remain, the body is in good shape for the first year or year and a half, and that's enough. And for humans, well, we were smarter, and so we evolved ways of living socially that meant that we were safer in our wild environment than mice are. But even so, if you go back, you know, sort of a few thousand years, humans had a life expectancy of, yeah, sort of 25, 30 years. So all you needed was a body that kept itself in pretty good condition, perhaps through to 40 years. And what happened beyond that was not a concern, you know, sort of in terms of natural selection. So this is how the disposable soma evolves. And going back to this fundamental question of immortality of the germline versus disposability of the soma, when I wrote the first paper proposing this idea way back in Nature in 1977, I suggested that we should see that, you know, at or around the time that the future somatic cells differentiate away from the germ cells, that you should see a reduction in the investments that you make in cellular maintenance and repair. So I was absolutely thrilled when just 5 years ago, one of my colleagues in Newcastle, quite independently from me, showed that if you culture embryonic stem cells, which are effectively germline, and you allow them to undergo differentiation, in the first 2 or 3 days after differentiation occurs, you see a comprehensive downregulation of a whole swathe of mechanisms for cellular maintenance and repair. And this colleague, Gabby Soretsky, she showed that this happens not only in mouse embryonic stem cells, but also in human embryonic stem cells. So, I mean, I am excited by the possibility that these fundamental mechanisms apply.
Yes, because, I mean, I was just, the reason I was smiling a little bit when you were talking earlier, when you were talking about life history and the cycles and so on, I was conjured up an image of a mouse having given birth to offspring, thinking, oh, well, now the kids have left, I can kick back and sort of enjoy the rest of my life. That's not happening.
It doesn't happen like that. And it's not as if, sometimes people completely misunderstand this idea that you switch off, you know, you've done it, you've produced your kids, you know, sort of nothing left to do, switch off the mechanisms for cellular maintenance. It's not like that. There's no programming of aging. There is absolutely no evidence at all that there are genetic clocks or mechanisms that count out our span of years and activate some change that will produce our death. In this context, it's just that the mechanisms of maintenance and repair were set at a lower level in a mouse than they are in a human, and nothing changes. It's just that because they're set at a level that does not protect us from the accumulation of damage, the damage happens. There may be some kind of secondary regulation to say, when you've got damaged cells in a particular organ, what do you do about it? Do you kill the cells? Do you get them to undergo cell death, apoptosis? Or do you just simply say, that cell's, we don't want that cell to divide anymore, so we make it go into what's called replicative senescence, a sort of permanent arrest of growth, and say, that's fine, your division's done, just hang in there, keep that tissue together. You know, there's quite a lot of evidence now that shows that these things have been tuned a little bit by natural selection. So there are layers and layers and layers that we're beginning to expose of understanding the complexity of aging.
As replicative senescence, it's funny that at the same time as Bacon was working, of course, Descartes was doing experiments to see if he could prevent graying of hair. Amusingly, those studies, it's in the last 2 or 3 years that somebody's actually looked at melanocytes, melatonin stem cells, and discovered that in fact it's a replicative senescence of in those cells that resulted in them no longer producing. So we finally have solutions to some of those things that were being thought about all that time.
You can go back even further than Bacon. If you go back to Aristotle, Aristotle speculated quite a lot on the factors that regulated the length of life in animals. Right. Aristotle had some pretty gloomy views about that as well. He felt that the thing that shortened lifespan was sex, and that each sex act would reduce length of life. This is an idea that sort of carried on in human consciousness, and it was very eloquently expressed in the writings of the metaphysical poets. But it's quite an interesting, quite a profound idea. Sigmund Freud, in some of his writings, you know, sort of talked about this in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. He Right. talked about the death instinct of animals. What's happening there, of course, is that, you know, sort of we're seeing coming through the rather gloomy and disturbed psychology that many of us have about the aging process. We're all, when it comes to it, we're all pretty mixed up about aging. It's pretty profound that aging leads to mortality. And so, you know, mortality is a hard thing to get your head around. And for that reason, a lot of people are deeply confused about aging. And a lot of people also seek a purpose. So I said a moment ago that aging is not programmed, and yet you will find that, you know, perhaps as many as 9 out of 10 people believe that aging is programmed, and yet there are very, very compelling reasons that derive from evolutionary logic that tell us that it cannot be programmed. And also, you know, there is absolutely zero evidence that aging itself is programmed. I think quite a lot of biologists, let alone members of the general public, find that idea challenging, but it's important to pay attention to it, because if aging were strictly programmed, then so it would not have the malleability that we see it has. And the fact that aging, as we now know, is not strictly programmed gives the hope of being able to influence the trajectory of aging, so that all of the extra accumulating years of life we're getting with the gain in life expectancy could contribute to us years of good quality life. If a program was operating, then we could just be fatalistic about it and say, nothing I can do is going to change it. But actually the science tells us that aging is strongly influenced by the personal choices we make, so there is everything to play for.
But why stop there? Why just to go back to your earlier point, why not then say, well, so there is no limit if it's not programmed, then we can find a fix and another fix and another fix?
In theory, we can. Because there is no absolute program, so it is possible to imagine postponing the accumulation of damage progressively, and that would result in increasing life expectancy. There is no fixed limit to human lifespan. There is no maximum lifespan beyond which we can say a human will never live. But the reasons for imagining that it's, you know, sort of going to happen, or the reasons rather for saying that we should not imagine it's going to happen anytime soon, are, number one, we're learning that there are multiple mechanisms, and these are very complicated and going to be really quite hard to modify in the profound way that would be necessary. It's going to take quite a long time to do that. And secondly, as we get older, a variety of kinds of faults accumulate within the cells and tissues of the body, so that although each of them is in principle kind of amenable to change, there are so many of them that actually this is why, as we get older and older, it seems as though we are coming up to something which, if not a hard wall, is, you know, sort of an ever steepening slope, and it becomes harder and harder to keep going. So if we look at very long-lived human beings, we know that many more people are making it to 100, more people are making it to 110, but if you look at the statistics for maximum life expectancy, you'll see that those are not shifting very much at all. And when you get to be a super centenarian, that's someone who's over 110, the death rates are terrifyingly high. People who make it into that age range, sort of just find it harder and harder and harder to keep going from one day to the next. So what I'm saying is not that the possibility of progress in this direction is not possible. I'm just saying that everything about the biology of aging tells us that pushing that frontier backwards is going to be challenging. But there is absolutely no reason to imagine that it cannot and will not be done progressively, incrementally in time. I think the greater challenge, though, is to recognize that already life expectancy is increasing. And our concern, rather than accelerating the rate of increase in life expectancy, should be focusing our understanding of the scientific mechanisms of aging to ensure that during the lengthening lives that we have, that our quality of life remains as high as we can possibly make it for as long as we possibly can. So the focus should not be on life extension, but the extension of good quality of life within the current lifespan.
I hear from some people that the notion of singularity, for example, of breaking through an age barrier and so on, becoming essentially immortal, although, you know, on the ground it sounds like a jolly good idea, there's a lot of people find it somewhat hubristic.
Yes.
And just for a select technological few who think this way, whereas you're saying even if that were possible, I mean, we've got an awful lot of problems to solve with the people who are existing right now, who are going to exist for the next 50 years, and let's at least improve the quality of life as we're going along, right?
Yes. And I think it is really important. I actually get quite angry with people who put the emphasis on life extension and the idea that science may have as its ultimate goal, and perhaps an attainable goal, the banishment of aging altogether, is that this, in some senses, is profoundly ageist. Because what it is doing is devaluing the agenda of the people who are old already and the many, many people who are destined to become old in time. It's saying that it's more important to work to push back human survival and to perhaps achieve some kind of immortality, goals that I think are so far-fetched in terms of our current science as to be really sort of not worth addressing. But it does minimize the challenges, the real challenges that are faced by older people in today's world. We live in a profoundly ageist society, and I think what we have to do is to harness the, you know, sort of the considerable potential of aging science in order to be able to address the things that degrade quality of life as you get to older ages. I think we've got a great deal to learn from older people. It's very interesting when you research with older people. We're doing a very big project in Newcastle upon Tyne, where we're working with, we approached everyone who was born in 1921 we started this in 2006, so we were approaching them in the year they turned 85. Yeah. And we had done a lot of preparative work. We managed to get 74% of the total population, that includes everyone, those who are in care homes, those who have dementia, 74% of them agreed to take part in a detailed investigation of all the factors, the biological, the medical, the psychosocial factors that affect their health. What we're discovering very interestingly is that among people of this age group, although they have a lot of things wrong with them, they rate their health and quality of life surprisingly high. I think we need to focus on what life is like for today's older people. We need to very aggressively try to get people who are researching diseases for which age is the single biggest contributing factor, and there are many, many such diseases, obviously dementia, obviously cancer, heart disease, a whole
Alzheimer's,
spread of diseases that are the focus of research. There's not that much attention being paid at the moment to what it is about the intrinsic aging of the body that increases your risk of developing these diseases. And I believe rather profoundly that when we can get that engagement between the fundamental science of aging and research on the whole spectrum of age-associated diseases, then we will begin to see some very, very exciting advances. So I think one of the things that, so I would like to see happen as we, you know, sort of begin to address the challenges of aging over the coming decades is that we start to see real evidence that we are taking this enormous challenge of understanding aging and being able to deliver improvements in the quality of the later years of life as seriously as it merits. As I said, the simple statistic is that life expectancy is increasing in the developed countries at the moment by 5 hours each day. In many, many developing countries, the rate of increase is even faster than that because they're playing a kind of catch-up. There's only a handful of countries in the world that are not participating in this process, and these are countries that have distinctive problems of their own, such as very high levels of HIV infection. Mm-hmm. So this is a global challenge. It's an enormous global challenge. And we see a lot of discussion about other global challenges like climate change. Mm-hmm. Quite rightly, climate change is a major issue. We see a lot of attention to issues like global terrorism. Again, you know, a major, major challenge. I believe, and I'm not making this as a sort of headline-grabbing claim, I just believe absolutely, profoundly, and on scientific grounds, that the challenge to future humanity that is associated with population aging is significantly greater than those other two challenges, provided we don't boil ourselves through, sort of uncontrolled global warming. We're going to have to confront what is happening to the change in life expectancy. So, you know, it really is about time that we started to give this enormous challenge the respect, the attention that it merits.
Tom Kirkwood, thanks very much.